we return. It is today's topical current, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. In 1945, Victory in Europe Day brought to an end the war which plagued the continent for 6 long years. There was dancing in the streets, soldiers swilling wine and euphoria among the victors. But the continent was in shambles, bordering on anarchy. Joining us now is World War II historian Keith Lowe. He wrote a book about the destruction of Hamburg in 1943 and has recently published Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. And Keith Lowe joins us from London. Good evening to you, sir.
Good evening to you.
And good evening. Good to have you with us. So what we think of the end of World War II was not really an end at all. It was violence and chaos in Europe. Can you just please give us a thumbnail of Europe in the months and years immediately following May 1945?
Well, yes. I mean, we have this sort of cozy idea, don't we, that everything kind of went back to normal after May the 8th, 1945. But, of course, after a war that huge, nothing could go back to anything resembling normality. The whole of the continent was in complete chaos after the war. There was, you know, not only the physical destruction with entire cities destroyed by bombing and by armies passing through, but there was also a vast amount of human destruction. 35 million people killed, 13 million children orphaned by the war. These are things which you don't really recover from in the sort of blink of an eye. It takes years of rehabilitation and rebuilding and so on. So there was chaos. There was a complete power vacuum for months, sometimes years afterwards. And you know, people filled this power vacuum by finding revenge, fighting civil wars. I mean, all kinds of violence continued for months after the war was supposed to be over.
I remember seeing and have this image of course, Berlin on the final days of the war and the Nazis and Hitler in the bunker and all of that, and so many people were trying to flee from being under Russian control. Was that part of the problem?
That was definitely a problem. If you can imagine, there were probably about 8 million people in Germany who had been displaced from parts of Eastern Europe. So these people, they've been taken by the Nazis and they've been brought to Germany to work as slave laborers. Now, at the end of the war, of course, the Allies wanted to get everybody back to the places where they came from. But a lot of the people who'd come from Eastern Europe really didn't want to go back there, especially Poles. Really didn't want to go back to Poland because it was now controlled by the communists. So they stayed. I mean, they fought against repatriation. They wanted to stay in Germany. They wanted to come to places like Britain or to the U.S. Rather than be sent back. So there was a big problem there of getting people home, and if they wouldn't go home, what to do with them.
So what did happen to them?
Well, a lot of them languished in displaced persons camps for years after the war. I mean, there was one guy I spoke to who lives in London here, an old Polish guy, who he lived as a child in a displaced persons camp in Germany right up until about 1955. He was only allowed to come to Britain as late as that, 10 years after the war. So his whole childhood was spent hanging around in these camps, playing with weapons that he found lying around in the woods nearby, you know, that kind of thing. His childhood was not anything that any of us would recognize as a normal childhood.
I've read that the Americans probably could have reached Berlin before the Soviets, but that Eisenhower put the skids on the American army so that the Russians or the Soviets could capture Berlin. Is that true?
It is true, yes. I mean, his priorities were not, you know, he didn't want to get to Berlin. He didn't see that as a real priority. The amount of American lives and British lives that would be lost by pushing that fast to get to Berlin, he thought it just wasn't worth it, since the Russians were going to be getting there pretty quickly anyway. Why not leave them to pay the butcher's bill? That is true.
You divided your study into three areas: vengeance, ethnic and racial cleansing, and the civil wars. So why don't we begin with what you call perhaps the most universal, which is vengeance. You talk a lot about that.
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, there was a lot of unfinished business at the end of the war. I mean, the way that the people of Europe had been treated during the occupation by the Nazis, there was a real desire for revenge against especially Nazis, but also just Germans in general, because there was a lot of anti-German feeling. And anybody who collaborated with the Germans was also targeted. So, yeah, there was all kinds of violence in the wake of the liberation against all these different groups.
But wasn't some of the vengeance rooted in legitimate grievances? And didn't it actually help them to establish some moral equilibrium?
Yeah, I mean, there's a strong argument for that, absolutely. I mean, the things which the Nazis did were unparalleled in history. I mean, it was, as you can imagine, if you or I had experienced things like the Holocaust or you know the destroying of our communities and our families, how would we feel about it? The only way to get back some kind of sort of moral equilibrium was either by an official kind of justice or by revenge. Now, in the aftermath of the war, there were no really strong institutions to do the official part of the official side of things, so that there weren't really proper trials for quite a while after the war. So, in frustration, people took the law into their own hands. And in some ways, you can say that a lot of the people who received revenge did deserve it. But at the same time, there were plenty of innocent bystanders who got caught up in the violence.
Was there similar vengeance and revenge against the Japanese after they surrendered by the countries that they had occupied?
There was vengeance against the Japanese, but probably not quite to the same extent, because the Japanese were actually, in a lot of places, were left in control of the areas that they had occupied, simply because the Allies didn't have the manpower or the language skills to control the areas that they had liberated. So quite often they did leave Japanese units in control of those areas. So vengeance was a little bit more difficult to achieve in Asia than it was perhaps in Europe.
There also was never a similar trial like in Nuremberg against the Japanese high command or the emperor. Why is
that?
There were
some trials in Tokyo, but they were not the same as the ones which happened in Nuremberg. And of course, the emperor was exempt from the trial. So the person right at the very top was never going to be punished. So yes, the sort of justice that you would expect at the end of the war in Japan was never going to happen.
Going back to Europe, when you say there were no ways of meeting out justice officially, what happened to the authoritarian institutions, the police forces, the governments? What happened? What state were they in?
Well, it depends where you are in Europe. A lot of them were just simply swept away. They joined in the fighting and they were killed. Those who weren't killed didn't want to make themselves known. They sort of melted away after the liberation. So as a consequence, really there was nobody in control apart from the Allied armies. But at least while the war was going on, the Allies weren't prioritizing law and order. They had to carry on fighting the war. So in places like France and Western Germany, which were liberated before they got to Berlin, there was this chaos in the sort of back areas of the Allied armies, which caused all kinds of problems for them as they fought on.
How did the discovery of Nazi death camps affect civilians and Allied soldiers?
Oh, well, imagine how you would react coming across something like that. I mean, generals like Eisenhower deliberately made their men go and visit these places so that they could see what it was they had been fighting for. Actually, the Russians did exactly the same when they came across Majdanek and Treblinka and so on.
And they marched civilians through too, correct?
Sorry?
Didn't they march civilians through as well?
They did, yeah. Especially in Germany, they made sure that the local populations went into these places to see what had happened, to see that when these things appeared on the news, that they wouldn't be dismissed as mere propaganda. They really wanted these people to see what had happened in their name. And the way that Germans especially reacted to this was absolute horror. I mean, they kind of knew what had been going on, but had been trying to ignore it. And having it really put in front of their faces, they couldn't ignore it anymore. I think actually that was probably one of the best things that the Allies did, because as a consequence, the Germans today, I mean, they've had this taught to them from a very young age. Every generation is taught this now because they were shown it personally. Whereas in Japan, they didn't really get to see the atrocities that they committed. So there's a bit more skepticism about it in Japan, even still today.
We're speaking with Keith Lowe. He's an historian and author. His latest book is Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. On today's Topical Currents, one short break now, and we'll be right back.
And we return 20 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and also historian Keith Lowe. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. We have email and tweet.
Right. Radio at WLRN.org is available, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents, and we think we have it now down, so we'll get your tweet. That's at Topical Currents. So I found it shocking that anti-Semitism would persist and actually increase after the war. Why and how did it manifest, and in which countries was it the worst?
Yeah, well, you would think, wouldn't you, that Jews would be treated with some kind of sympathy after the war, but actually, really, at best, they were quite often treated with indifference, and at worst, with outright hostility. Mm. The reasons for this is that, when Jews had been rounded up and sent away to concentration camps, especially in places like Poland and Hungary and Romania, all of their property had been shared out. Usually, so they went to the people in charge, but then a lot of this property was shared out with people, the poor, peasants, and so on. So for the first time, in lots of rural areas in Poland and Hungary, there were poor peasants who were given decent furniture and decent clothing, which had been effectively stolen from the Jews. Mm. So now imagine the war comes to an end, and some of these Jews start returning home. Now, these poor peasants, they don't want to give this property back. They have a vested interest in not having the Jews return. There was actually a joke during the rounds in Budapest in Hungary after the war that went something like this. It went, a Jew returns from a concentration camp, and he meets his neighbor. And his neighbor says, "Oh, my goodness, I wasn't expecting to see you. How are you?" And the Jew replies, "Oh, terrible. I've just come back from the concentration camp, and I have nothing left but the shirt on your back." So this is the kind of atmosphere that the Jews are coming back to. They're not welcome. They're treated resentfully by people who don't want to give their property back. Some of them are living in Jewish flats. They don't want to give, or Jewish apartments, Jewish houses. They don't want to give these back. So slowly the attitude towards Jews gets ratcheted up, sort of more and more sort of propaganda, really, against them. And eventually this breaks out into violence. Well, in Poland, it broke out pretty soon, but the worst violence happened in 1946 against Jews. And naturally, you know, if you've been through that sort of situation, if you're Jewish, you're not going to hang around. So they left in their hundreds of thousands from Eastern Europe, even after the war, when they thought they would be welcomed back. They had to leave, and most of them went to Israel or to the States or to Britain.
How did the ensuing Cold War politics and nuclear strategies affect Europe?
Well, the Cold War, in some ways, saved Europe, at least Western Europe. I mean, the attitude of the American administration, at least immediately after the war, was they just wanted to finish everything up and bring as many of their American soldiers back home again, as was perfectly reasonable. However, Europe was on its knees. It really needed help. And it was only really by American intervention that they stayed in Europe and provided that help. They gave, the Marshall Plan and so on. They provided military assistance in places like Greece, and they stayed in Germany. The only reason they did that was because they perceived a brand new threat from the Soviet Union. So for Western Europe, at least, I think the whole reason why there was this economic miracle which brought Europe out of this chaos was simply because the Cold War meant that the United States had to stay and help out.
Getting back to the Jews being unwelcome in their homeland, you said there were other minorities that were also unwelcome. Who are you referring to?
There were minorities all over Europe. The way that Europe had been carved up after the First World War meant that there were Hungarians living in Slovakia, there were Ukrainians living in Poland, Poles living in Ukraine, and so on. All across Europe, there were these large ethnic minorities. Now, a lot of people thought that the whole reason why the war had begun in the first place was because of these ethnic minorities, and they just wanted to get rid of them, especially Germans, for obvious reasons. So there were communities all over Europe who were pretty much expelled from their countries and sent into Germany. So there were about between 12 and 16 million Germans who were forced to leave Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary and so on, sent into Germany. And along the way, there was, of course, a lot of violence that accompanied these expulsions.
How were the Germans' notions of racial identity and superiority used by other groups after the war?
This is a really interesting subject, actually. I'll give you one example. In Poland, in Czechoslovakia as well, quite often Germans were rounded up and they were forced to wear white armbands to identify them as Germans.
What color? Because you broke up there.
White.
Sorry, they were forced to wear white armbands.
Okay.
I mean, it was very much the same idea as making Jews wear the Star of David.
Right.
And this was a conscious decision. I mean, they also rounded up Germans into ghettos. They eventually put them into concentration camps where they were quite often treated in brutal ways which were deliberately the same as the way that Jews had been treated in their concentration camps. Now, I don't want to draw too many parallels between the Holocaust and the way that the Germans were treated, because, of course, there is really no comparison. But there were some local commanders who deliberately took the things that the Nazis did and tried to apply them to German people.
Go ahead.
No, that's you go ahead. I finished.
Okay, I just wanted to ask if they were put in their own camps.
Yes, they were. They were put. They they reopened some of the camps which had housed Jews and prisoners of war and so on, and filled them back up with Germans, particularly in places like Poland and Czechoslovakia. They did this because, you know, they were expelling their German populations. So in order to do that, they had to round them all up first. But in the meantime, they realized that this was a good source of free labor. So they worked a lot of these people really hard, treated them badly, and kept them for sometimes years before sending them back to Germany.
We actually had a couple of German POW camps here in the South Florida area after the war.
Yes, yeah, then there were plenty of German POW camps not far from me in England as well. We actually kept, you Americans were pretty good about this, you kept your prisoners of war, and then when the war was over, you tried the ones who needed to be tried and sent the other ones back. Whereas we hung on to our prisoners probably a little bit too long, if I'm honest, because we Brits also realized that they were a good source of free labor.
Oh, and how long were they in? Did they stay in England?
They stayed in England to the middle of 1947, up until the end of 1947. It was only actually because of American complaints to us that we Brits finally decided we, on moral grounds, we really better let these people back to Germany.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with historian Keith Lowe about the post-World War II climate in Europe. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Here's a Delray Beach caller, Warren. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call, Joe and Monty. Once again, a wonderful program. And Keith, what a pleasure. I, as a historian and someone who lived in England, what a pleasure to speak with you. Fascinating topic. I was given to believe that there were a few reasons of, well, obviously there were reasons that the Emperor of Japan was spared, whereas General Tojo, I believe, was executed. The emperor traditionally was regarded as a holy figure in Japan, and as we see when we watch or read James Clavell's Shogun or see The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise, while there were militant warlords who led the countries into the Japan into these great conflicts and performed atrocities, the emperor was depicted as someone who was basically sequestered from all that stuff. Also, that near the end of World War II, when the emperor was going to do the radio broadcast of, you know, announcing the surrender, there was an attempted palace coup by the militants, the warlords, to try to stop him from doing so.
Any comment, Keith Lowe?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to say that my book is mostly about Europe, so you probably know quite a bit more about Japan than I do. But what I understand about the way that the war with Japan ended was, yes, indeed, the emperor was regarded by the Japanese as a sort of almost like a deity. And he was sort of untouchable as far as they were concerned. But as far as America was concerned, they really saw this as a way to end the war in a way which would allow the Japanese to keep a little bit of their face. So it was really a way to make sure that they could save as many American lives as possible by giving the Japanese an easy way out of the situation. I mean, they knew that the war was lost, but this at least gave them a way to exit the war in a way with some dignity.
We're speaking with Keith Lowe, an historian and author. The name of his book, Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. Another break on Topical Currents, and we'll return. And welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. And we're speaking with historian and author Keith Lowe. The name of his latest book is Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. If you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576 or email radio, WLRN.org.
And we have a link to the book at the Topical Currents Facebook page as well as the WLRN.org.
So you said that Americans kept millions of German soldiers in open fields with no shelter, no sanitation, and little food. Where were they kept, and why was there no intervention by the government?
Well, to begin with, they were put in these open air cages. This is why while the war is still in its last throes, and all the prisoners of war that they gathered, and they gathered hundreds of thousands of them, they had nowhere to put them. So while they were still fighting, for the meantime, they put them in these big sort of open air cages. They just had a sort of a wire perimeter around the edge. And these captured German soldiers had nowhere to sleep. They had nowhere to get food and water and so on. This was really kind of inevitable to a degree because, a war is going on. There's no way to supply such vast numbers of people adequately at such short notice. But the problem was that they were kept in these places for really a little too long, and the supplies which did come through were then not handed out nearly as efficiently as they should have been. Whereas the British, they tended to release their prisoners quite early on. They were criticized for that, of course, because a lot of these people had needed to be put on trial, but the British just decided that they didn't have the resources to keep hold of them, so they let a lot of them go. Whereas the Americans were much more zealous about keeping hold of their prisoners for much longer, and as a consequence, there were more fatalities in American camps than there were in British ones.
How long did the Americans keep them?
Oh, for a period of months, not years, weeks or months. Whereas the British tended to keep them for a period of weeks, really. Up until June, July, August 1945.
Okay.
Of course, post-war, there was a political void in Europe. Tell us about the bitter fighting between the left and right in France and Italy and the violence that ensued.
Yes, well, I mean, we have this idea, don't we, that all the places which embraced communism after the war were all the Eastern Bloc countries, Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Romania and so on. But actually, the places where there was most interest in the communist party were in places like France and Italy. There were actually more than a million members of the Communist Party in Italy alone at the end of the war, which is a huge number, exponentially more than in any part of Eastern Europe. These people, they had real kudos because the Soviet army had done so well, and they were linked to the Soviet army. They had sort of ties with the Soviets, but also because they were regarded as the real resistance. They were the people who really put up a fight against Hitler and Mussolini and the Vichy government in France. So the fact that they were victorious and that they were, they were heroes. So there was a lot of interest in communism in the days immediately after the war in Western Europe. Now, this really did not suit the British or the Americans, as you can imagine. That's where a conflict began between allies, if you like.
What was Spain like post-war?
Spain, well, as you know, Spain had not been involved in the Second World War. It had hardly been involved because it was a neutral country. Spain had already gone through its own terrible time in the immediately before the war, during the Spanish Civil War. Mm-hmm. So the people there had no appetite for getting into another huge conflict. So they stayed out of the Second World War. they were kind of recovering much more efficiently because they hadn't had so much violence so recently after the war.
And we'll take another call or two. This is Hans in Fort Lauderdale. Hi. Hans, you're up.
Yeah, hi.
Speak up.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to mention I had a great uncle who also, he died, what they call the dead marches they used to have in Czechoslovakia, and they had the people walking around the city. They had to keep walking until they fell to the ground and they were killed, or killed by hunger or exhaustion, you know. I haven't heard your writer mentioning that, but I just wanted to add this. They call it the Dead Marches or the Todesmarsch in German.
Or when?
Todes.
The Todesmarsch, okay.
Yeah, it was between 44 and 45. Autumn of 44, late April 45, that happened then. It's in Wikipedia, you know.
Are you aware of that, Keith Lowe? Or?
Absolutely. The Czechs were actually some of the first people to react to the end of the war by deliberately expelling their Germans. So they, in the best cases, they would put these people on trains and send them out. But of course, the whole of the transport system had been bombed during the war, so there weren't a lot of trains to go round. So rather than do that, local militiamen, who had no real authority apart from the fact that they were the ones with the guns, these local nationalists, Czech nationalists, just rounded up whole communities of Germans and force-marched them across the border into Germany. Quite often, when they got to the border, the Allied soldiers, the British and the Americans and so on, refused to let these people come across, so because, you know, they had no reason to come across. So they were sent back to their villages and their towns, and sometimes this happened two or three or four times. And along the way, they received all kinds of really terrible and brutal treatment from the Czechs. Some of them, it has to be said, you can imagine that they might have deserved it, but along with them, there were huge numbers of women and children and so on who had nothing to do with the war, had nothing to do with Nazism, who got caught up in all this violence. I mean, I'll give you one example. There was a town called Přerov, which is in Czechoslovakia, modern-day Czech Republic, and there was a Czech militiaman there who stopped a train which was full of Germans being expelled across the border. And the reason he stopped it was supposedly so that he could check to see if any of them were Nazis. But that night, he and his men shot 71 German men, 120 German women, and 74 children, the youngest of which was only 8 months old. Now, later on, when the leader of this group was asked to justify at least the killing of the children, he said, well, you know, what was I supposed to do with the children after I'd killed their parents? So this is the kind of attitude that there was, this sort of real fierce desire for revenge against anybody who happened to be German, regardless of whether they were Nazis or not.
When you say he was asked why he shot the children, who would have asked him? Who was he accounting to?
The reason we know about this is because this is one of the very few cases which actually ever saw a court. I mean, this sort of thing happened all the time, but this particular man was brought before a court, before a tribunal, and was made to account for his actions. I wish I could tell you what the verdict of the court was, but I'm afraid I don't know that.
Where did most of your research come from for this book, and how long have you been at it?
Oh, goodness. My research came from all over. I spent about 5 years researching and writing the book. I went to archives in France, in the United States, here in Britain, of course. I had bilingual researchers helping me out, because I don't speak Polish, for example. I can get by in Italian and French, and and in bits of German, but you know, I had Polish people and Czech people and Croatian researchers helping me out with archives in those countries. So yeah, I was all over the place trying to gather information for this book.
Evidently, this is the first comprehensive view of post-war Europe. Why do you think it took 7 decades nearly to write it?
Well, that's a really interesting question, actually. I think, you know, when you read histories of the Second World War, Europe is always treated as a sort of like a single unit. And you have these huge armies sweeping from one side of Europe to the other, and we always look at the whole continent as a whole, as a unit. But as soon as the war comes to an end, suddenly there's a sort of retreat into each individual country. It's like almost like each individual country guards their own history of what happened next. So there are plenty of books, for example, about what happened in France after the war, right, or what happened in Italy, you know, written in French or written in Italian. But there isn't anything which really goes back to treating the whole of Europe as one big unit. Because, of course, a lot of the same things were happening all across Europe. The same themes, the same violence, the conflict between communism and capitalism, all these things were happening everywhere, not just in individual countries. So, yeah, I thought it would be interesting to compare these countries and see how, actually, they were all really very similar to each other in lots of ways.
You speak about the refugees mostly wanting to avoid being under the jurisdictions of the Soviet because they feared brutality. Was that founded? Was there a lot of violence, mayhem, raping, and that kind of business?
What, by the refugees? Or
by the Soviet invaders.
Ah, yes. There was what happened when the Soviets arrived was really quite terrible, especially in Germany, because they really were bent on revenge in Germany. So it's estimated there are about 2 million women who were raped by Soviet soldiers in the immediate aftermath of the war when they arrived. There's actually a really famous book called A Woman in Berlin, written by one of these women who experienced repeated rapes at the hands of Soviet soldiers, and it's an incredible. She is really an amazing woman to have survived all these horrible events and come through and still keep her dignity. It's a wonderful memoir. I absolutely recommend it to anybody who's interested in that sort of thing.
Called A Woman in Berlin?
Yeah, it's called. It's doesn't the author. Doesn't have a name. It's an anonymous woman.
Oh.
And it's called A Woman in Berlin.
We're speaking with Keith Lowe, historian and author of Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. One more short break, and we'll be back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our segment with historian Keith Lowe. And we're making every attempt to be able to put that book that Mr. Lowe mentioned, The Woman in Berlin, a link on both our website and the Facebook page. Let's take a call or two. We've got Gary in Boca. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. Mr. Lowe, I just wanted to mention one interesting event that has followed up after the Cold War, that the expelled Germans, those Germans that were expelled from, let's say, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, have now been very well organized. There is a department in Germany now trying to get them recognized as a group of people who suffered during the war and after the war because of their expulsion from Western Poland and the Sudetenland of Germany. And I'd like to see if you could comment on that.
Yes, well, absolutely. This is quite a powerful political lobby in Germany these days. It's actually been very controversial recently, because a lot of these people who had been expelled from places like Czechoslovakia or Poland really wanted to get their what they regarded as their property back. And, you know, after the end of the Cold War in the 1990s, they mounted a series of legal challenges to try and get their houses and their farms and so on back, which kinds of problems in the European Union, as it's now become. And, well, I mean, even when we have treaty negotiations between different states in the European Union, this subject always comes up. For example, there was a recent treaty, the Treaty of Lisbon, which was made a few years ago, and the Czech government refused to ratify it. And the reason they refused is because there was one clause in this treaty which seemed to possibly open up the idea that some of these Germans would be able to reclaim property in Czechoslovakia. So they sat on this and refused to sign anything until the whole treaty was rewritten to make sure that this would never happen. So it's a very much a live issue, even today.
Well, it must be a very elderly contingent, though.
Elderly people, but also their heirs.
Oh, I see.
Right.
So there are middle-aged people who are fighting the battle on behalf of their parents, if you like.
I'd like to know if there's been denial on the part of Europeans to acknowledge their part in the atrocities, or if they have acknowledged them in the atrocities that occurred in the post-war period, and if that was maybe a reason that a book wasn't written sooner on all of a more comprehensive book written sooner.
What do you mean atrocities committed by, say, French people? Or
yes.
Right. There have been one or two books very recently in France, in French, or in Italy, in Italian. Especially there's one book in particular I'm thinking of in Italy, which caused all kinds of controversy in Italy because it was really painting the picture of Italian fascists being the victims of all these evil communists after the war. You know, the traditional way of looking at it, you know, they started the problem. They were horrible during the war. They did all kinds of atrocities. And actually, at the end, what the communists did was really nothing in comparison. So these kind of these conflicts are coming up every now and then. People are sort of more willing to look at these things nowadays because, you know, we're getting... It's almost 70 years on now, and the people who were involved in them are all beginning to die out slowly. So there's less heat in the arguments, if you like.
Right.
Let's take a quick call. We're really very short on time. We'll take Eric in South Miami. Hi.
Yes, hi. When I arrived in Denmark as a little boy, 6 years old, in 1946, I remember my father answering the door. The police were there to collect the guns that had been distributed during the war by the British. They had parachuted the guns into the underground, and they had a list of everybody who had a gun in Denmark. And I was wondering, what happened to all the guns that were everywhere, all over Europe, everyone had a gun, the underground. They were all swept up somehow. I was just curious as to how they managed to do that. In Denmark, it was very cooperative. Everyone turned in their guns after the end of the war, but did anyone else?
Well, that is a good question. Getting hold of the guns was a real priority because, of course, you're not going to achieve law and order unless you can disarm all the people who are going out committing revenge or taking the law into their own hands and so on. So there were a series of amnesties in places like France or Italy or Denmark, as you say, where people were allowed to hand these guns in. They were hunted down as well by the police. Hunted down makes it sound terrible, but yes, they did have some lists of some people. But of course, a lot of the communists, particularly in places like France, didn't want to give these guns back because, you know, they were still waiting for the revolution to happen. So they quite often they buried caches of these weapons in secret locations. I dare say there's probably piles of these weapons still lying around underground somewhere, forgotten, all around Paris.
Go ahead.
There you go.
I know you're running out of time. I wanted to relate a story about the famous meeting between Franco and Hitler.
Quickly.
I got this from firsthand. A friend of mine who passed away had a lunch with Franco, and he asked him about the meeting. Everyone asked about Franco, and asked him, "Did you really say no to Hitler?" Hitler had to wait half an hour for Franco, and he said, Franco told him, "No, I didn't tell him no. I pointed out to him that the gauge of the Spanish railways was wider than the French and the German, that the German trains wouldn't be able to pass through Spain." And Hitler looked at him, realizing at that moment that it was all over because there would be no Spanish trains waiting for him.
And okay, we have to run, Eric. That was a
okay.
Nice story. We have
sure.
to run.
Bye-bye.
We certainly want to thank you, World War II historian Keith Lowe. His book is Savage Continent, and you can find links to that book on the Topical Currents Facebook page as well as WLRN.org. Thank you very much, Keith Lowe.
It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in this hour. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction today from online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at the website WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is with two Stanford University professors who've written Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. And to the calendar, on this day in 1928, 85 years ago, the birth of actor Vince Edwards in Brooklyn. He played Ben Casey in the hospital drama series and had a serious rift with Richard Chamberlain, who starred as Dr. Kildare. Edwards died in 1996. And on this day in 1956, 57 years ago, the birth of actor Tom Hanks in Concord, California. His break came in 1981 as one of the leads in the TV sitcom Bosom Buddies. Horrible. Tom Hanks even has an asteroid named after him. One more while we recall the feudal legacy of the old St. Louis Browns. On this day, 1948, 65 years ago, the debut of Major League Baseball's oldest rookie, 42-year-old pitcher Leroy Satchel Paige for the Cleveland Indians. Baseball legends say Paige threw faster than any pitcher in history. That was the opinion of both Bob Feller and Joe DiMaggio. So we leave with Satchel Paige, whose pro career began in 1926. Quote, "Work like you don't need the money. Love like you've never been hurt. Dance like nobody's watching." For Bonnie Berman, this is Joseph Cooper. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.